Hello. It's October 24th, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is a special edition of 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new special edition episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. So before I begin the show, I want to go ahead and say that since I brought back new episodes, I have tried, really tried, to have new episodes every week for the rest of the year. However, I did not manage my time correctly and went without releasing an episode for a few weeks, and I sincerely apologize. And also, due to unforeseen circumstances, my mic that I've had since the beginning of the show literally broke in half. It, like, broke in half, and I had to go again without recording, obviously, until I replaced it, and I really apologize for slacking and having these issues to make me not have new episodes out frequently. But as I mentioned before in the show, today is a special edition episode because last week was Thanksgiving in Canada. Now, call me ignorant, but I did not know my Canadian listeners celebrated Thanksgiving. And right around the time I found this out, I discovered a case that occurred during their Thanksgiving holiday in the 90s, and I thought I would report on it. Well, I want to go ahead and also say, even though this case takes place in the 90s, there was a current court case about it that just wrapped up, and the verdict was just read not too long ago, so please keep that in mind. And lastly, I'm going to go ahead and warn you that this episode is very graphic, and listener's discretion is advised. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1994, and in the coastal city of Barrie, Ontario, about 60 miles away from Toronto, this city was known for its beautiful geography and the residents' quality of life, meaning that Barrie was known for its stunning nature, like their hiking trails and unique beaches, which had their very clean yet cool-feeling water, where many natives and possibly tourists could swim, sail, or just relax on the cool sand. Also, an article states Barrie's weather was mostly so calm that many residents could enjoy their day, whatever the season. Lastly, Barrie's crime rate was considered very low, and it was considered the safest city in Canada in the 90s. However, in October 1994, when many families around the country were preparing for the Thanksgiving holiday, one young woman in Barrie met a tragic end and would not live to spend this special day with her loved ones. In the following case, you'll find out who the victim was, the investigation, and the aftermath in a case I title Butchered in Barrie. On the night of October 10, 1994, 16-year-old Barrie, Canada resident Christine Chico was having phone trouble at her family's apartment, so she went to ask her neighbor if she could use theirs. When she arrived at the apartment, she knocked a few times but got no answer. So, reports state, she opened her neighbor's apartment door and made her way inside. When she got inside, however, she noticed two men who didn't live there, inside. She passed one of the men in the kitchen, going through the cabinets, and she passed another man who was coming out of the bathroom. She thought it was strange, especially since neither one of the men said anything to her, but she continued to try to speak to her neighbor. As she made her way to her neighbor's bedroom, she opened the door and the lights were off. But when she turned the lights on, she realized why she couldn't get a hold of her neighbor. There on the bedroom floor was her neighbor, 20-year-old Catherine Gennaro, and she had been murdered. Not much is known publicly about Catherine's early life, but what is known is that Catherine grew up in a loving, middle-class family as an only child in Toronto. For reasons unclear, Catherine left home at the young age of 16, and she and a boyfriend moved to Barrie, although it was unclear, publicly, how long they had been together. Reports also state that the year after Catherine and her boyfriend moved to Barrie, they welcomed a daughter, but just a short while later, the couple broke up, and Catherine and her daughter moved to a new apartment in Barrie. However, Catherine had some financial struggles after moving to her new apartment, and it's unclear what type of job Catherine initially sought to pay for her and her daughter. But reports state, sometime after moving to Barrie, she came across a local biker bar where she met some prominent bikers who were involved in less than safe and legal activities. According to reports, Catherine met a man named William Theakston, nicknamed Woody, at this bar. And he was the leader of a biker gang called Para Dice Riders. Reports don't talk about Catherine and Woody's relationship too much, but what is stated is that after getting to know each other for some time, Woody decided to help Catherine make some extra money and hired her to be a runner and seller for him, meaning with drugs. Reports state that Woody was a well-known drug dealer in the area, and he hired several people as his handlers and dealers for his products. And now he had Catherine on his roster. Catherine worked for Woody for several months, running drugs for him, until he trusted her enough to stash some of the drugs at her apartment and started selling them from there as well. When he proposed this to her, Catherine was hesitant at first, but agreed. But she knew her daughter could not be around the drugs or transactions, so she placed her toddler daughter with some family members until she got out of the business and got a better and safer job. After she began to deal out of her apartment, possibly due to trust issues, Woody made a key for himself and one of his right-hand men, since his products were being stored at her place. All types of people would come in and out of her place, buying products from pills to cocaine to almost anything their heart desired. And it was raking in money for her and Woody. Catherine thought about stopping the dealing, but at the time she was financially stable, and stopping didn't seem right to her at the time. As months passed after she began dealing in her apartment, Catherine decided to start dating again. Reports state that Catherine went out on dates with a few different men by the time mid-1994 came around. But one man impressed her the most, and his name was Douglas. Douglas later learned about Catherine's job, but it didn't seem to matter to him. However, reports state Douglas did not participate in drug dealing or using any of the drugs. Also around this time, Catherine became infatuated with a nearby neighbor named Bruce Ellis. However, there was a problem. Bruce was married. Reports state after Catherine and Bruce met, the two started as friends at first. But as they got closer, Bruce began to hang out at Catherine's apartment, and he disclosed to her about his numerous affairs. They got so close that Catherine would let Bruce sometimes cozy up with some of his lovers at her place so he could hide his affairs from his wife. However, reports state Catherine herself became attracted to Bruce, and the two began an affair as well. Their affair went on for a while and continued after she began a relationship with Douglas. As weeks went on, though, Catherine saw less of Bruce, and he eventually broke off the affair with her, as he said he was trying to work on his marriage. But this made Catherine upset, even though she had a new boyfriend. Reports state that Catherine would sometimes stalk Bruce to see who else he was dating, and she became incensed that on one occasion, Bruce snuck into her apartment to entertain another woman and left her there for Catherine and Douglas to find. When she saw the woman in her home in September 1994, Catherine demanded that she leave and told Douglas they would not be sleeping in that bed. Instead, they would be replacing it with a new bed. Catherine usually didn't mind when Bruce used her place to hook up. But why was she so angry with this woman in her bed? Well, reports state Catherine allegedly heard about this particular lover of Bruce's and claimed to Douglas that she was an exotic dancer, she had AIDS, and thought she was filthy. And as they waited for the new bed, they slept on Catherine's pull-out couch. During this time as well, Catherine continued to sell for Woody, and everything was going okay with the sales until October 1994, when, while she was out at a bar, she accidentally dropped around $500 worth of pills in a toilet that Woody had given her to sell. Panicked, Catherine knew the product was no longer sellable, so she tried figuring out how to explain the situation to Woody. However, she didn't go to Woody right away, but she did mention to some of the people in their circle about what happened, and they suggested that she make enough sales of other drugs to make up for the lost product. Catherine thought this was a good idea, but she was still afraid of what Woody would say or do if he found out. Reports state Catherine tried to make enough profit to pay back the cost of the pills, but by October 9th, on the Thanksgiving holiday, she was not close enough to making enough, and she seemed very shaky and afraid. On that night, though, Catherine made more sales and ended up going to some bars that night, and also had friends over, including a man named John Benz, who was also friends with her former lover, Bruce. John bought marijuana from Catherine that night and stayed to smoke. As time passed, though, John witnessed several people coming and going from the apartment, and he also noticed Catherine pacing around like something was on her mind. He also saw her making a phone call, and while she was on the phone, she seemed scared. And after she hung up, Catherine told him he had to leave as more people were coming over. John stayed a few minutes longer to finish his joint, and after he left, he sat in his truck for a little while in front of her apartment and then went for good around 4 a.m. And sometime after John left, Catherine was murdered. After her neighbor Christine alerted the police, detectives came to a scene out of a horror movie. According to reports, when detectives went inside Catherine's apartment, they saw Catherine's nude body lying face down in her bedroom on the floor next to a bed frame, with her left hand outstretched above her head, while the other hand was down along her right side, and a large amount of blood surrounded her. Upon further examination, they saw several cuts on her body and scratches on her face, and determined her cause of death was by stabbing. When detectives looked around her bedroom, they noticed it looked disheveled, but not ransacked. And when detectives searched Catherine's bathroom, they noticed her tub had a bloody ring around the interior, suggesting that maybe Catherine had been attacked while she was taking a bath, as she was nude, tried to get away, and whoever killed her finished the job in her bedroom. However, detectives didn't have any clear answers so early in the investigation, but while still in her apartment, police didn't have any clues as to who murdered Catherine and why. But they did come across a peculiar piece of evidence, Catherine's wallet. Reports state, by this point, police had an inkling her murder may have been a robbery due to her bedroom being in disarray. But when they came across Catherine's wallet, which was found on the floor behind a framed poster leaning against the living room wall, detectives found $1,253 and some change inside. Detectives thought it was odd Catherine's wallet was found in such a strange place, and they wondered if Catherine put her wallet there or if someone else had. But if it was someone else who put her wallet there, the motive of her murder more than likely wouldn't be a robbery, as there was cash left inside. Also, police noticed a phone cord was left in Catherine's apartment, but there was no phone attached, meaning either Catherine disconnected the phone herself or someone took it from her. But detectives thought a missing phone was obviously an odd scenario. Again, though, it was so early into the investigation that detectives were gathering evidence and decided to gather more clues before trying to make any concrete conclusions. As detectives were investigating, they spoke briefly with Christine, and she explained that she was at Catherine's to try and use her phone. But then, the detectives also spoke with the two men Christine came across in the unit, who were still there when detectives arrived, and they introduced themselves as William Theakston and Paul Daigle. They told police that they had been there for a while, and that they did indeed come across Catherine's body, but did not call 911. They also confessed and said that after they found her body, they panicked and wiped down a lot of the apartment so they wouldn't be seen as possible suspects. Thinking the men were acting strangely and could answer more information, they requested the men go down to the police station for more questioning. Reports state that after Catherine's body was removed from the scene and ample evidence was gathered, detectives interviewed William and Paul separately. William told detectives he went by the name Woody, that he was a leader of a local biker gang, that he and Catherine were friends, and that she worked for him pushing drugs. He also added that on the night of her murder, Catherine called and left him about 5 voicemails, with one that said, quote unquote, "I've got to talk to you. It's really important." And that she would call him back, but she never did. He also stated that he had Thanksgiving dinner that day with Paul and another woman, and then the two men made their way to Catherine's. Not to check on her per se, but to try and find some cough syrup to get high on. When the men got there, Woody said they saw a younger girl hysterical, who was later identified as Christine, go past him while he was rummaging through the cabinets. He then said he went to Catherine's bedroom, turned on the light, saw her body, turned the light back off, and panicked. He said once he saw his body, he said to himself, quote unquote, "I'm going to jail forever, and then I gotta get out of there." Then he told Paul to wipe down areas they touched so as to not be named as suspects. Woody also added that Catherine was his best friend, but they didn't always get along, and that at the time of her murder, she owed him a few $100 for a bed he bought for her. He also added he had no idea who would kill her. Paul told detectives that on the night of the murder, as Woody mentioned, he had Thanksgiving dinner, and then Woody asked him to drive him around so he could run errands. He said that he and Woody got to Catherine's around 7 or 8 p.m., and then Woody let them in since he had a key, and they immediately started rummaging through her cabinets for the cough syrup. He added that they thought she wasn't home since she did not call him back after she left the voicemail, and he said while they were inside, he used the bathroom and noticed her tub full of blood, and that coagulated blood was clogging the tub's drain. Paul then added, after he left the bathroom, a girl came by him screaming. Lastly, he said he and Woody wiped down some areas, and they left. After their interviews, Woody called a lawyer, and then he and Paul gave their clothing and samples of bodily fluids to detectives for testing. With this evidence, detectives took the clothing and samples to their crime lab and waited for results, which was to take a while. Meanwhile, on the day after Catherine's body was discovered, police received an anonymous tip suggesting they take a look at Catherine's neighbor, Bruce Ellis. And they also disclosed that they needed to look at him because they knew he once had an affair with Catherine, and that she knew about some of his other conquests. So with this, the police brought Bruce in for questioning. Bruce said he knew nothing of the murder and barely mentioned any relation between him and Catherine. And after 16 minutes of interrogation, police let him go. After weeks turned into months, detectives spent this time going in and out of Catherine's apartment, examining any blood stain or bodily fluid found to try and figure out who killed her. However, by 1995, detectives were getting nowhere, and testing for Woody and Paul's items still had no results. So, detectives decided by March 1995, several months after the murder, they would go to the public. In a press conference, detectives discussed Catherine's murder, told some of what they found at the crime scene, and pleaded for information regarding any suspects. As luck would have it, the day after the press conference, a man named Wayne Restoul called in with information and evidence. Reports state that on the morning of March 16th, Wayne was making his way to work around 7:30 a.m. when he stopped and fed some ducks at a local creek, which was a few blocks away from Catherine's apartment. He told police as he was feeding the ducks, he noticed a phone and its cord upside down at the bottom of the creek. He thought it was odd, but then he remembered the detective's press conference mentioning a missing phone from Catherine's apartment and thought maybe this was it. So Wayne put the phone in a plastic bag and went to work. After his shift, he called the police to report what he found. Police met with Wayne and he showed them the exact spot where he had discovered the phone. Police were able to identify the phone as Catherine's, and the numbers programmed in the phone were identified as well, but they felt none of the contacts were viable, so they were back at square one. After a year had passed since the murder, police still had no viable suspects, and DNA from the scene and the samples from Woody and Paul were still inconclusive. So they decided to reach out to Ontario's Provincial Police, as well as the Center for Forensic Sciences in Toronto, and to a private lab to try to get any results from any of the evidence. As the rest of 1995 came and went, and other years went by, detectives working on Catherine's case interviewed countless people and continued to gather evidence, only to still get no conclusive results on a viable suspect, until 5 years later in 1999. Reports state that in November 1999, DNA came back from a blood sample, and it matched a man by the name of Robert McQueen. When detectives tracked down Robert, they were taken in for a loop when Robert came in for questioning, because the man who walked in was an original possible suspect, Bruce Ellis. But Bruce was only an alias, and Robert McQueen was his legal name. With Robert, aka Bruce, back in for questioning, detectives grilled him again about Catherine's murder. But this time, they were more intense as they questioned him on his whereabouts on the night of the murder, along with detailed information relating to his sexual relationship with Catherine. They also told him they knew about his relationship with a woman named Faith, who Catherine was adamant had AIDS and threw her out of her house. And detectives told him that new investigative techniques were being utilized and they would be able to use DNA and other methods to identify suspects in crimes. Reports state that detectives also asked Robert what fluids of his could be found at the crime scene and where they could find his DNA. Robert said his saliva and hair could possibly be found there, as well as blood from his shaving. However, during his new interrogation, Robert felt more pressure from detectives and ended his interview. Even though Robert, aka Bruce's, second interview was over, detectives in Barrie and other agencies continued to try and solve Catherine's murder and continued to look at him as a possible suspect. However, as more years went on, police eliminated and added suspects regarding the case, and it seemed like they were no closer to solving the case, even though there were some suspects in mind. Fast forwarding 20 years later to 2019, though, a woman contacted police to report She had seen a man running across the street near Catherine's apartment with a phone near the time of her murder, suggesting the man was running with the phone taken from Catherine's apartment. And after looking at a lineup of photos from suspects detectives had decades earlier, the woman picked out who she was certain was running with the phone. 2 years later, by January 2021, a DNA match was finally conclusive from the apartment, and it was a blood sample that finally matched a suspect. And it was the same suspect the woman from 2019 said she saw run near Catherine's apartment with a phone. And after police arrested the suspect, they announced that they brought Catherine Gennaro's alleged killer to justice. And as they originally suspected several years earlier, it was Robert McQueen, now aged 61. Reports state that after Robert was finally arrested, police charged him with first-degree murder. But as he was held in jail and the investigation continued, his charges were reduced to second-degree murder in December 2022. He was granted bail in July 2023, and his trial date was set for September 2024. When the murder trial began on September 4th, 2024, the prosecution or the Crown of the Courts opened the trial by blaming Robert McQueen, aka Bruce Ellis, as Catherine's killer. Because he was in a relationship with Catherine while he was married and living nearby her home. They continued by saying that after he ended things with her, he allegedly became angry that Catherine allegedly harassed him and his wife, and they shockingly revealed something else to the court. That on September 16, 1994, just weeks before her murder, Catherine had an abortion, and the baby was supposedly Robert's. With all of this information, they told the courts that they believed no one else would have the motive to kill her. The first witness to the stand was Catherine's neighbor, Christine, who testified about what she witnessed that night and why she was there. The second and third witnesses on the stand were the two lead detectives on the case, and they testified about what they witnessed at the crime scene and the interviews they conducted with potential suspects. The fourth witness was Paul Daigle, and he testified that what he witnessed in Catherine's bedroom and bathroom was something out of a Halloween movie. However, the prosecution could not question his co-witness, William Woody Theakston, because he had passed some years before, around 2018. Next to testify was Robert, aka Bruce Ellis's ex-wife, who was considered the star witness to the press. In her testimony, she mentioned that she and Robert's marriage was often rocky. Since she knew he and Catherine were close, she would kick him out to her place sometimes to get away from him. But she never thought they'd had an affair until she ran into Catherine weeks before her murder and she told her she was pregnant with his baby. Shocked and angry, his ex-wife testified that she lied to Catherine and said he had had a vasectomy, so that was impossible. His ex-wife also testified that Catherine had been spreading rumors that one of Robert's lovers had AIDS, and Robert and his ex-wife thought she was tarnishing his reputation once word got back to them. Once her testimony was complete, the prosecution called on the detective who processed the crime scene DNA, and they said Robert's blood was found in two places in the apartment, in a door jamb and above the couch on a wall. Then the prosecution rested. When it was the defense's turn to present to the court, They stated there was no concrete evidence to name Robert as Catherine's killer, and they should be looking at one of Catherine's business partners as her murderer, i.e. William Woody Theakston, or one of his friends. Especially since they knew Catherine accidentally lost $500 worth of pills she was supposed to sell for him. The defense also played several interrogation interviews with Woody and his associates. They told detectives that they were not involved, and some said they didn't believe Woody would kill Catherine because they thought he didn't have it in him to do so. However, all of the witnesses in the interrogation videos, except for Paul, could not testify because by September 2024, they had all passed. After showing the interrogation videos, the defense questioned the woman who said she saw Robert running with a phone near Catherine's apartment and asked her if she could still identify Robert as the man running with the phone now. As in, did he look like the same man? The woman admitted her memory might be a little fuzzy almost 30 years later, but she did ultimately identify Robert again as the man who was running down the street with the taken phone. The defense also presented to the court that they were skeptical about the DNA findings found in Catherine's apartment that matched Robert, because Robert himself said he spent some time at Catherine's apartment, meaning he may or may not have been there on the night of the murder, and since he spent so much time at her apartment, it was going to be pretty much obvious that some DNA of his would be found there. Lastly, the defense were pretty much adamant and really sticking with Woody as the main suspect in Catherine's case and named him as Catherine's killer. And then the defense rested their case. After the jury sequestered for several days to decide on a verdict, on October 9th, 2024, Robert McQueen was found not guilty of the murder of Catherine Gennaro. To the delight of his family and to the dismay of Catherine's, including her now adult daughter, who told the press after the verdict, quote-unquote, "I was two at the time of her murder, and it has been a lifetime that has been taken from me, and a lifetime that I will never be able to share with her. To all the investigators and the Crown Attorney's Office, I am grateful for your hard work, but I am disappointed and distraught by the verdict." It's unclear if Catherine Gennaro's case is officially closed, or if any new charges may be brought against a living suspect. The story of Catherine Gennaro's murder comes from the sources of CTV, Barry Today, Midland Today, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, so that one was intense. I hope I wasn't too all over the place because I planned to have this episode as a mini-sode, but as I did more research, there were more and more articles coming out regarding Catherine's case, and I guess because it was like literally the verdict was read just like a week or so ago, a lot has come out more about the case and potential suspects and the court case, the verdict, her personal life. And like I mentioned, not a lot was given about her early life. It doesn't really have to be. But, you know, I like to give, you know, some background on some of the victims. But like I said, she, you know, I give a little bit. And she's a single mom from Toronto and all that good stuff. Moved to Barrie, had a boyfriend. They broke up. And you heard the story. But I was a little confused as to why the verdict was not guilty. Now, granted, I did mention in the story there were a lot of people who came in and out of Catherine's apartment, and, you know, she did sell drugs out of her apartment, so that, of course, can lead anyone to be her killer. You know, it could have been a drug deal gone bad, it could have been anything. But to me, what I read and researched, even though he was found not guilty, I thought for sure the jury would find Robert, aka Bruce, guilty because
He had the motive. His wife testified that Catherine confronted her about their affair. She also talked about her telling people that one of Robert's former lovers was an exotic dancer who had AIDS. That's not verified at all. But maybe Catherine heard this and spread the rumor because she was, you know, maybe intimidated by that lover, or I don't know, maybe wanted Robert to herself. But then again, he had a wife, so I don't know what she was thinking about doing that. I'm not shaming Catherine at all, but I do think without, you know, having a source of your, you know, word, that could be really, really bad. And, you know, it would make sense for Robert to be the killer if Catherine was indeed harassing his wife and him about her relationship with him, and he just snapped. That would mean, you know, that would make sense to me, but the courts found him not guilty, so he's not guilty. On the other hand, I know she also worked for Woody. Now, the man, John Biggs, who was at her apartment smoking weed the night she was murdered, he said that when she told him to leave, like I mentioned in the episode, he stayed a little longer in his truck to smoke the rest of his joint. But the report stated that I forgot to mention that when he was still smoking, he saw Woody and another man come by the apartment, who was later identified as Paul. And he had known about Woody around town, and he was nervous. He was like, I don't know what he's doing. He didn't know. He told the police he didn't know what he was doing there. So he, you know, snuck down in his seat. He didn't want to be a witness to anything Woody was about to do or Woody had business with. I'm not saying Woody killed Catherine, but John told police, according to reports, that he knew what Woody was about. He knew he was a, you know, tough biker and a drug dealer, and he was not to be messed with. He didn't want to be seen by any of Woody or his people. So he snuck down to his truck and eventually left. Regarding Woody, I don't know if he knew about the missing product that was the pills, the $500 worth of pills, because he told detectives that Catherine owed him for the bed. Now, she could have owed him for the bed she wanted replaced after the woman was found in her bed, but I don't know if he said it was a few hundred dollars, but it could also have been the $500 for the pills she lost, because, you know, it makes sense. Maybe she owed for both. Maybe he got mad that the product was lost. Maybe he did do this to Catherine, as the defense was adamant about. That would make sense as well, because he was a drug dealer, product was lost, and he wanted revenge on that. But he also said Catherine was his best friend. She was a very good worker for him, quote unquote. So again, he's not here to defend himself either, because he passed around 2018. According to reports, Paul said he had nothing to do with it. They didn't mention Paul in the courts about him wanting her dead, but he could have been a henchman. But again, we don't know, because Paul was not tried for her murder or really, you know, brought to justice for her murder. So we never know. Like I said, there's so many people who could have wanted Catherine dead, but we just now don't know, even because Robert, the main suspect, was found not guilty. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition episode of 90s Crime Time, and I hope you thought it was pretty interesting. If you'd like what you heard and haven't done so already, please leave maybe a hopefully good review for 90s Crime Time. I know that my delivery is not the greatest, and I don't have a big studio to record in, but I do try to bring you some crazy yet interesting cases from the 90s. So if you haven't already, please leave a good review. If you don't, I understand as well, because my voice is not everyone's cup of tea, nor is the show. But like I said, I understand. If you like, you can also follow 90s Crime Time on Instagram, where I primarily post new cases of the 90s on the weekends on the page. And if you'd like to follow, please feel free. And with that, I will see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.